You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada, indeed the world's top leaders, to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Dr. Joanne Liu, International President of Doctors Without Borders. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders that come to McGill and other universities across this country. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Henry Mintzberg, one of the world's great management thinkers, and his daughter, Susan, who's just finishing up her PhD at McGill at the School of Social Work at McGill University. And we're in Susan's kitchen. I'm very excited about today's show because Henry has been a close friend and colleague for over 25 years. We've worked together running the Advanced Leadership Program, the International Masters of Practicing Management, and I was one of the founding directors of the International Masters of Health Leadership. And we spent many, many hours working together and occasionally writing together. It's a great pleasure to sit down with Henry and his daughter Susie today as well. I want to briefly provide a bit of background about Henry. His father was a manager of a dress shop many years ago now, what's called the schmutter trade here in Montreal. And from his youth, he took away two things. First, that he did not want ever to work for his father, and that he was confused and very mystified by how his father ran the business. It was in a particular way from back then. And perhaps this is why he went on to study managers in his PhD at MIT and again for decades since then. Henry is truly one of the great strategic minds of the world. He's developed several renowned strategic management theories that I still teach in my class today. I want to start off by picking his brain a bit. Like, where does strategy come from? I ask a lot of CEOs, and I've interviewed Michael Porter, who has a different tact on it. What's your view today of where strategy comes from?
Well, I think the most interesting strategies come from all kinds of weird places. Because strategy is a learning process. Sure, you can analyze and do all that, and you know, but the interesting strategies come from a sort of chance meeting, a surprising event, a sort of realization that there's an opportunity. You know, my favorite story is IKEA. How did IKEA get into selling its furniture unassembled? Because a worker tried to put a table in his car and the legs wouldn't fit, so he took the legs off, and then came the critical strategic moment. If we have to take the legs off, so do they, the customers. And that became the origin of probably the most important strategy in the furniture business ever. So strategies come from all kinds of interesting places. And good strategists are opportunists in the sense they see things that other people don't see. So it's as much seeing as it is analyzing, probably a lot more seeing than it is analyzing. Sure, analyze markets. Once you've got an idea, make sure the market is there. But analysis doesn't give you a synthesis, and strategy is a synthesis.
So during the pandemic, we're stuck at home. We're meeting on Zoom. Does that make strategy a little bit harder to potentially happen? That you don't have those chance meetings, you're not running to people in the hall. Has it changed how we work to some degree?
Well, it's two different questions in a way, but yes, it has an effect on things like strategy because you don't bump into each other. You're not out as much, especially if you're locked down. So you don't have that opportunity to see and say, oh my goodness, look what's doing, or look, there's an opportunity there. Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that? It changes work if companies are going to stay home. It's interesting that Musk is forcing his workers back to work. And I think, whereas other people are saying, stay home, that's good, it's fine. I think it's a mistake, and depending on what you're doing. But if you're doing individual work, sure, I write books at home. I went from 75% home to 100% home. That was my change from COVID. But it's dangerous to assume that you can keep going that way if you need that kind of interaction, especially if you're brainstorming and trying to come up with some new product, some new project. You need that loose, flexible form of communication, and Zoom is not that.
So this is a CEO series. I interview CEOs most weeks. one could argue that it's too much of a focus on one person. What is the role of the CEO, and do we kind of worship them a little bit too much at times, Henry?
We worship them a lot too much. We just assume that it's all one person. And if the company does well, it's got to be the chief executive. And if the company does bad, it's got to be the chief executive. And it's infantile. We treat leadership, the way we view leadership is infantile. It's like we're looking for some big daddy. So I think where it makes a big difference is in entrepreneurship. When people have an idea for a new business, and these people manage in a very grounded way. Entrepreneurs are in their, if they're in retailing, they're in their stores, they're in their factories, they know what's going on. The IKEA story, it turns out, I didn't realize it till recently, the IKEA story, it was the chief executive entrepreneur who was there when the worker was putting the table in the car, okay? But when you get so-called professional management, nothing professional about professional management. Management's not a profession; it's a practice. But when you get so-called professional management, they could be attached and involved and committed and so on. But all too often, they're disconnected, especially if they've been through an MBA program and they think reading a case is what you need to make a strategy.
You're listening to the CEO Series, and I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Today we're speaking with a colleague I've worked with for decades, the renowned strategist and author Henry Mintzbergen, and his daughter Susie, a PhD candidate in social work. Susie, you've been teaching on the IMHL, the Masters of Health Leadership that your father, a bunch with Leslie and other people, founded. What strikes you about how they're teaching on the IMHL that is different than traditional models that you've seen?
Well, the whole way the classroom's set up and just that kind of interactive learning, I think, where you have a lot of discussion happening at small round tables, discussions with multiple professors in the classroom using very creative kind of, you know, you'll walk into the classroom and see drawings on the walls and not on the walls literally, but like, you know, stuck up. But the other thing is I'm now advising students for like every module they have reflection papers. That's what they're graded on. So they've brought me in to help advise students on these reflection papers. And when they asked me to do it, I said, you can't get anyone better than a social worker to do this because all we do is reflect. It's reflexivity all the time. But just the fact that the papers are on, you know, these reflection papers where you're really having to, you're being graded on how you're thinking, not just about the material, but just about your experience.
So it's applying the ideas to your own world. And seeing how they connect and how it's actually useful.
Yeah, and I mean, what I find interesting, like I always say this, I say we need, you know, we need social workers, you know, all over the place. Like, so I always joke that we need social workers in construction, right? If you drive around Montreal, you know, you go from, here's the detour, you take your detour, the detour brings you to another detour, which brings you to another detour. And social workers look at things systemically, right? So I always joke that, you know, they should hire social workers in the construction industry so that someone's looking at the whole systemic plan to see, okay, maybe, you know, we should kind of, you know, delay this construction so when they take the detour, they're not being headed to another detour. And so I think when where I'm going next, I think in my life, we'll see where it leads. But I love the idea of taking the kind of thinking of social work or what social work is based on, that whole systemic way of looking at the world, and applying it outside of social work.
So how long were you a social worker yourself?
I was never a social, like officially part of the order of social worker. I wasn't, but I was, I worked in social work. So I worked in community mental health for years. And originally I didn't actually want to go into social work. I just had some prejudice about, you know, what social work was until I kept being pushed to go get a degree in social work. I'm like, no, until I realized that the work I'm doing is social work. So I may as well go get my degree in that. So I went to get the degree with the idea of being able to continue community work, but more kind of in institutional settings. And then ended up going on to do a master's and a PhD. So I never actually went back to social work per se. But I worked in community kind of mental health, social work type work for 10 years.
The pandemic is one of the things you were talking about, and congratulations for winning the Principal's Prize for Public Engagement for 2021. And part of that was around the pandemic and mental health. So mental health really came on the agenda, I think, during the pandemic, part because of the Olympian woman and then the woman at tennis. Where boomers were kind of going, snowflakes, grow up, but the world said, no, yeah. This is actually important. What have we learned about mental health in the last couple of years?
Well, I'm hoping we learned a lot. I think one of the biggest issues in mental health that really affects people, especially with severe mental illness, is stigma. Like in 2022, there's still so much stigma around mental illness, which is absurd. You know, mental illness is an illness the same way diabetes is an illness. So just because it affects, you know, the top part of your head, you know, people are still unwell when they have mental illness. And yet a lot of people don't get help because they're afraid to say it. They're afraid to talk about it, you know, the shame, et cetera. So the fact that there's stigma around it is just atrocious in this day and age. And I think what one of the things that the pandemic did, and I hope going forward it will make have an impact, is that a lot more people were affected by mental health. A lot of people. Like, I mean, in psychiatry, they talk about a separate pandemic happening in psychiatry during the pandemic because so many people have needed help. And so one of the things I'm hoping is that, you know, as more people experience it, it'll help demystify the stigma a bit more. I think a lot of stigma comes from people who just don't know what something is or, you know, have false ideas about it. And the more people who have experienced this, you know, the more sensitive they're going to be about it.
If you don't mind me asking, how did the pandemic affect your mental health?
I mean, we did okay. Like, I work in mental health, so I think, you know, our family was pretty safe. But if I look at, you know, I have two teenage kids and one who's younger. For my middle child who was just starting high school, you know, a lot of isolation, just starting to make new friends, suddenly was sort of cut off, you know, at home. So that was a bit tougher. I mean, we did okay because he's lucky he lives in a house where he has, you know, parents who are very sensitive. I work in it, so I'm very in tune and I know how to get help for it. But I'd say like teenagers really, really suffered. They were cut off from so much of, you know, important connections at a time in their life that's so critical. I think to a certain extent, I actually like the solitary working at home, not having to run around as much. Yeah. That was sort of nice. But I'd say I'm quite sociable. I like being around people. So I'd say just really that isolation became a bit harder over time. And, you know, working on a PhD is already lonely, so this was even lonelier, or working on a thesis, I should say. So it slowed down, you know, my ability to think as well as I would have liked to.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Henry and Susie Mintzberg, one of McGill's most famous professors and authors, and his daughter, who's a McGill PhD student in social work. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll continue our conversation about mental health and also hear about how do you age gracefully in Henry's remote oasis north of Montreal.
Top-notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again. You're listening to the CEO Series. Today, I'm speaking with the Mintzbergs, Henry, one of the most famous management professors in the world, and Susie, doing her PhD in social work here at McGill. So Henry, mental health during the pandemic, was there anything that you struggled with in your partner that was more intense than in normal times?
No, I mean, we were very lucky. We went in the opposite direction. We flew home from Peru just as it was starting here. We went up north for a weekend. We came into town, realized what was going on, packed up, went to the house in the country, and didn't sleep in town. We slept one day in town in the first year.
Wow.
And maybe 20 days altogether. We moved up north. We had talked about moving up north, but suddenly it became not only an opportunity, but the safest place to be in terms of avoiding infection before there were vaccinations and so on. And so, you know, we went out the back door on the lake, whether it's snowshoeing in the winter or canoeing in the summer. We'd take a walk down the road, which is a country road. The nearest neighbor, when they're there, is quite far away. So we were lucky. I mean, and emotionally, we were happier there probably than in town.
You have a new canoe out back. Tell us about your canoe.
So I have a 40 some odd year old canoe that was my pride and joy, weighed 41 pounds, a Kevlar, and last year it was finished. It just kept taking water, and the more I patched it, the took water somewhere else, and became a humpback canoe. It kind of had a little humpback in the middle, inwardly. So I didn't want to get rid of it, so we put it up in front of the house like a totem pole against the tree. So when you come to the house, you can see a canoe there. We just bought another one a few days ago.
This is really ultra light.
Yeah, this is 37 pounds. It's a Kevlar. It's a Kevlar canoe made by a Quebec company called Rayom. And yeah, it's amazing. I haven't put it in the water yet.
So are you still doing beaver sculptures and out cross-country skiing and stuff like that?
Yeah, we haven't put cross-country skis on for years. We just switched completely to snowshoes, but a lot of people have done that. And especially if you bushwhack, it's much easier on snowshoes. You can go up steep, steep hills on snowshoes quite easily. So we've done that, and I don't do beaver sculptures. I leave that to the beavers, but I collect beaver sculptures. I pick them out of the water, and one day we'll have a show.
If you're tuning in right now, you're listening to the CO Series, and we're speaking with my longtime colleague, Henry Mintzberg, and his daughter, Susie, who's doing a PhD candidate in social work. Reading an interesting book by a prophet at Harvard who writes for The Atlantic, and he's late 50s, but he talks about growing old well. And so the interesting issue is, how do you grow old well? And I think part of what you do is that you exercise and you're out there. You have a lighter canoe, but you're out there exercising as opposed to just, you know, giving up that stuff.
Yeah, like often during the week, but every weekend, we bicycle, or we take long walks, or we canoe down around the lake, or so we're always snowshoeing, bicycling, skating. We did a lot of skating. Got to tell you about skating. This is the quintessentially Canadian story. They make a 4 or 3 kilometer rink on the lake next door. But, you know, there's big mobs, not mobs, but more people. So one day I go down to our lake in the middle of the winter, and I see, you know, there was snow on the lake, so you don't figure you can do anything. I brushed the snow aside, turned out to be very light, maybe 10 centimeters, like 4 or 5 inches deep, and perfect ice underneath. So I started to clear a rink, not wide, as wide as the shovel, but maybe 50 meters long. That night I called my neighbor. I said, tomorrow let's join. You start in your house and I'll start in my house, maybe a couple of 100 meters, and we'll join up, which we did in no time, quite accurately. You know, when they made the Mont Blanc tunnel, they did it from the Italian side and the French side, and I think they were less than a centimeter off when they met. So we did the same thing, but in daylight it was easier. And then we noticed a neighbor was clearing a square rink at the end of the lake. So we spoke to him, and next thing he's whizzing by with his machine, and he made a rink that was about 1 meter wide and 1 kilometer long. So we were skating on there, and then we just did a little film to explain my work on rebalancing society by using skating. So the left foot is government and the right foot is business, and they got to skate in balance. You can't have government more important or business more important. And the shovel is what I call the plural sector, the community sector, that opens the path so that government and business can go forward. So that's all in a video on my channel, Mintzberg channel.
So part of it is keeping in shape, looking after diet and exercising. Part of it is, like, you could have retired 20 years ago or some silly thing. You could have retired, but you didn't. Why didn't you retire? What don't you get about the concept, Henry?
Because I'm having too much fun, and life is good, and I make my own hours. I'm just finishing a book.
But are you working less than you did 20 years ago?
I'm working freer. You know, I've been getting the book in the last couple of months, so I've been going flat out for a couple of months. But otherwise, yeah, I've got, you know, I can do what I like. Take the weekend. Well, we usually take the weekend off unless the book is a rush, and always in evenings and afternoons. And if we want to go bicycling in the afternoon, we just go. Yeah.
So, Susie, observations on your father growing older well. What are some of the things you've learned that you'll apply when you're in your 70s and 80s and all?
Do what you love. I think do what you love, and then you just keep going. I guess exercise, stay, you know, just if you're able and you're physically kind of in a position where you can do it, just keep going. And I think also just almost like a naive, like it's almost like don't, I mean, it's in a way he's, I guess you've grown, he's grown old the way he kind of ran his career. It's like, I'll do what I want to do. Don't tell me what I'm supposed to do and how I'm supposed to do it and when I'm supposed to do it. So it's, you know, I think there's, you know, I work in, my supervisor works in gerontology, so I've done a lot of work in that. And I think there's just too much negativity around people getting older. I should say, it was my first career was a photojournalist, and I did a project. When I think about it, it's kind of neat because I ended up working in gerontology research-wise much later in life. But I did a project where I spent a year photographing seniors at a, it was like a senior's day home or a day program or whatever. And the project was the positive side of growing older. That's what this photo project was. I have all these these amazing photos of these. Of these people. One of the women was 101 years old, and she lived alone. She invited me for tea. She was telling me about the previous queen. Like, it was amazing. So I think it's all about attitude.
So you're in your 50s. You're in the midst of it. Three, couple teenagers, smaller child, a partner. You're in the middle of it all. How do you age well into your middle age with all that stress, all that responsibility? Any key takeaways that have struck you recently?
I'm not sure I'm aging well. setting limits. I think, you know, trying to pick and choose what matters. I mean, it's challenging. I'm your stereotypical sandwich generation. You know, I've got kids who aren't young, but young. I've got, well, my father's pretty independent, but my mother needs a lot of help. So I'm really sort of, you know, bounced between my kids and taking care of an aging parent, and then happened to be doing a PhD much later in life. So there's, you know, the plate is full. I think for me, I was, you know, when I was a kid, I was an athlete. I was I was a ski racer. I did a lot of sports. I've kind of moved away from it, and I'm starting to slowly get back to it. You know, biking is my thing now. I've started biking during the pandemic. And I think for me, like, when things are overwhelming, and I was like this as a kid. As a kid, if I was in a bad mood, my parents would say, you know, get out, go run, go play, and I'd be better. And that has stuck with me as an adult. So I have to remind myself, when it's overwhelming, get out on your bike, go bike, and I always come back feeling better. So I think a lot of it is just, you know, changing your mind, staying active.
Today I'm delighted to be speaking with Henry and Susie Mintzberg. Henry is one of McGill's most famous professors. He's an author. And Susie is a McGill PhD student of social work after many decades working in the field of social work. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll ask Henry about his writing process, one of Canada's greater writers sharing how he goes about it.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with the Mintzbergs. Henry, one of the most famous management professors in the world, and Susie, doing her PhD in social work here at McGill. Do you have a discipline to writing? Like, do you kind of, this is what I do for writing. Tell us about how you write.
In the morning, and literally. First drafts are usually handwritten. I write. I can correct on the screen. Once Santa typed it, my assistant, but I write physically, and it comes out much better. I also have to correct often physically. I'll print out something I've written if it's a rough draft and correct it on paper, because I catch things on paper that I'll never catch on the screen. So if I'm typical, it could very well be that computers are destroying a lot of writing.
But you edit quite a bit. I've written with you a couple times, and you edit. You're not happy until it's got to a higher level.
Yeah, I'll edit. I mean, one book, I edited every chapter probably almost 10 times. I mean edit. I don't mean change a few words. I mean edit.
Really rewrite.
Scribble all over.
So to be a great writer, you need to work at it, and the phrases just don't roll out, but you've got to work on them and improve them.
Actually, they do roll out sometimes. And I kind of have taken to saying thank you, because it's kind of like they come down from the sky into my brain. I'm the medium that writes them down.
Okay. How many books have you written?
21 with the current one.
So what's the current book?
It's a revision of my book on structure. It's called Developing Organizations, Understanding Organizations, finally.
And how many years ago was the first edition?
1979.
So you've changed your thinking a little bit.
Not that much. I mean, it's clearer, sharper. There's more to it. It's more elaborate. It's not longer, but it's more elaborate. But you can recognize the first one and this one, although everything's been rewritten.
If you're tuning in right now, you're listening to the CO series, and we're speaking with my longtime colleague, Henry Mintzberg, and his daughter, Susie, who's doing a PhD candidate in social work. What's a different world to some? How much different is the world today than 79? Like, is it totally unbelievably different? Or how different is the world than back in 79?
Well, if you said pre-COVID, just to leave that out of it, not that different. I maintain that managing is managing, and it's always been managing, and I don't think it changes. I think the subject of managing changes, the topics, the technology you deal with, but the practice of management I don't think changes that much.
What's the next book, Henry? What's the book that's starting to form in your mind?
Maybe it's an elaboration of my Rebalancing Society. Actually, not a pamphlet, a short version, maybe 35, 40 pages. And maybe some personal stuff after that.
How about an autobiography?
Yeah, I'm thinking, I have a title for an autobiography. It's called Dreams I Never Could Have Dreamt.
Why that title?
Well, because I've had a very lucky life.
Susie, what book are you writing? Are you working on your thesis and turning it into a book?
My book is my thesis. I'm writing a thesis. Like, you know, now we can sort of do theses in three articles. I don't believe in at all. For me, a thesis is a book. Whether I publish it or not, we'll see. But I mean, that would definitely be a book. But years ago, I actually started writing a book that I'd love to get back to at some point that was based on the story of my two grandmothers, one who grew up in Hungary and one who grew up in New York. And I was really kind of comparing their story. I was writing it as fiction, but sort of taking these two stories and blending them together. So that's like a book I would love to write one day. But who knows? We'll see. I don't know if I'll write a book. I love to write. Right now I'm an op-ed. That's my big thing, is writing opinion pieces that I get.
How many have you written, roughly?
I'm up to about 22 in the last couple of years.
Okay. So, yeah. Around healthcare and mental health and things like that?
Not that much about mental health. A lot about kind of pandemic-related stuff. A lot about what was going on in seniors' homes early in the pandemic, about education, and a lot about government. It's sort of, you know, they're not specifically about kind of management and top town stuff, but it's all about, you know, these decisions that have been made during the pandemic and how we really need to be more connected between the top and the bottom.
I often ask people, if you're not a CEO, what would you be? But I think you've already answered that question by being a few things over your life.
I've been many things. I'm a chameleon, I think.
Where and when are you happiest?
With my kids. My kids make me happiest.
If you're tuning in right now, you're listening to the CEO series, and we're speaking with my longtime colleague, Henry Mintzberg, and his daughter, Susie, who's doing a PhD candidate in social work. What is your passion? When did you realize it, and has it evolved over time?
I've had multiple passions. What is my passion? Oh, I've had different passions. That's a good question. I'm not sure I can answer that in one kind of easy answer. My passion is people. My passion is people. People and their stories. I'm truly passionate about, like, people, knowing about people, caring about people, and making their lives better. But first passion is my family and my kids.
Well, I mean, favorite restaurant in Montreal?
Arhova Souvlaki. I've been going there since I was like 2 years old. Arhova Souvlaki.
It's not expensive.
I don't like expensive. Doesn't work for me. It's not because it's expensive. I just don't like fancy food.
Okay.
Arhova, but the original Arhova, the one on St. Viator.
Okay, when people are in town from out of town, they can go visit that now.
But lots of really good, we live in Verdun, and there's a lot of amazing restaurants kind of in Verdun now. So
Henry, your favorite restaurant in Montreal, when people come and visit, what is your favorite restaurant that you'd recommend?
I refuse to tell you the name because it's a special place, but it's a major Asian restaurant that has a downstairs that is not advertised, nobody talks about, and it's only Chinese people seem to go there in great big round tables. They have almost nothing but great big round tables. And
I think I know, but I can't remember
what it's called.
Well, we'll leave it as a secret so not to ruin it.
I don't want your millions of readers descending on this restaurant.
Henry, one final opinion I want from you. So are you in your 80s, are you reasonable, and you have grandkids literally downstairs, are you optimistic of the future or pessimistic, or you go, it'll work out?
When I look at reality, I'm pessimistic. When I think we can deal with it if we smarten up, I'm optimistic.
So you're not living a...
We're living in a situation now where one imbecile is capable of destroying all of us. And that man has nothing going for him at all except he controls nuclear weapons. If he didn't control nuclear weapons, he would have been dismissed as an imbecile long ago.
But you're hopeful that your grandchildren will be your age someday in many, many decades. Susie, thoughts on your kids and their future? And
I think the world they're inheriting kind of, you know, is a lot wrong, and their hands are full, you know, with climate change and all that. But I have to say, if I look at the generations a bit before that, but if I look at their generation, like, you know, let's say Z. I've been really impressed, I have to say. Like, maybe it's sort of the kid, you know, my kids and the people, their friends they have, but they've got their heads on right. Like, the story that I loved during the pandemic, when Trump had his first in-person rally, that, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, there shouldn't be in-person anything, and he's decided he's doing this in-person rally anyhow. And I don't know if you've heard this story, but, you know, he the place was sold out. He was expecting to get there to thousands of people, and when he got there, it was pretty much empty. And the story that came out was that the young generation got online on TikTok, I think, and they started kind of putting out these sort of things, go get tickets that you didn't have to buy, they were free. Go get your tickets. And this kind of went around on TikTok, and all these young teenagers, got tickets without any intention of going. So the place was sold out. And no one was there because of this young generation that found a way to kind of basically boycott it. And so I remember hearing this in the news going like, really? Like, I went to talk to my, you know, older daughter. I'm like, are you aware of this? She's like, yeah, of course. I'm like, did you get tickets? She's like, well, no, I'm not in the States, so I didn't. And I'm like, but you knew this was going on? She's like, of course I knew this was going on. And that gives me hope. I mean, that's brilliant. I think that's brilliant. And if that's the kind of, you know, kids that are going to be, you know, taking care of my generation when we're older, I'm good.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Henry and Susie Mintzberg. Henry is one of McGill's most famous professors. He's an author. And Susie is a McGill PhD student finishing soon her doctorate in social work. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. Next up, we'll ask Henry and Susie about hockey and if they're introverts or extroverts.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm speaking with the Mintzbergs. Henry, one of the most famous management professors in the world, and Susie, doing her PhD in social work here at McGill. What's the most memorable game at the Canadians you've been to, Henry, out of the 50 years, 60 years, 70 years? What's the most memorable game that you've been to?
That's a bit tricky. You know, I would more generalize. I just love the games where they're down two goals, come back, win it in overtime. I mean, that's happened often enough. I've been to an 8-1 game. I've been to some playoff games. Last time the Canadians won the Stanley Cup, Susie and Lisa went. And Susie was doing photography at the time. So she got up on something and was taking pictures of people rioting in Montreal. Was that the one when the Gazette?
Yeah, I can answer that question.
Yeah. So, Susie, most memorable Canadians game. You've been going for decades now. Most memorable game.
Can I give you several?
Sure.
Several.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the first one I remember is, I think it was the first game I'd ever gone to with my father. I was a kid. I don't know if you remember this. And we caught a puck at my first game. I still have it. And my father jumped up and we caught a puck. So that was a pretty
exciting
start.
That can be dangerous,
start,
though. Like, the puck's
exciting
going really...
start.
Wow.
Yeah, so I remember that.
Super
it was
dad.
Very exciting. And you had never caught one, I don't think. So like it was like my first game and caught a puck
and
for
as
me.
As we were walking around, there was another father with a daughter and they had caught a puck too.
So So that was the first one. But kind of fast forward years later, I guess my father was away at the time because how my sister and I ended up at this game. Otherwise, I think you would have been there. But we were at the final game of the Forum. And at the first game of the whatever it was called Bell's at the time. Yeah. I don't think it was Bell at the time, was
that's
it?
Right,
it
yeah,
was whatever,
true, yeah.
Molson, whatever center it was. So that was pretty cool. And I remember being there with Rocket, like there were all these like big timers. And I remember Rocket Richard was there and got something like a 10-minute standing ovation. Like it was incredible. It was like, so those two games I remember. And then there was another one I was thinking of recently and I've blanked out on what it was. But those two were
pretty, when was Saku Koivu came back from cancer?
I remember that. He was like one of my favorite players when I was younger. And I definitely remember when he came back. I don't know if I was at the game or not. But that was pretty exciting too.
So most impressive hockey player in your life, Henry, on the Canadians. We'll just limit to the Canadians. What was the best player or the most impressive or whatever measure you want to use?
Right now, I love to watch Suzuki. And what's the name of the other guy on the line with him? He's just so spunky, small guy. But some of the great goaltending, you know, Price. I go back to Dernan, okay. His name Dernan, Bill Dernan.
Yeah.
And what's his name became a politician.
Oh, Ken Dryden.
Ken Dryden. I mean, these guys are amazing, amazing guys to watch.
So you have a daughter, Lisa. In fact, you just spent a couple of weeks with her and her husband over in England. What's Lisa up to these days?
Lisa is carrying her photography, particularly animal, bird and dog photography, and taking it sort of to a new level. She's quite remarkable. And they're living up in the Lake District. So she's shooting swans like crazy. I mean, photographing swans like crazy.
Well, yes, the shooting. Yeah, we understood. Yeah.
The queen owns all the swans. You can't shoot a swan.
Well, that's good to hear. What is her husband was in a Ford executive, as I recall?
Was in a what?
He was a Ford executive at some point.
GM.
GM, sorry.
Yeah.
So her husband was a GM executive, but is retired, I believe.
Husband
yeah,
to be.
He retired early.
Oh, husband.
Husband to be. Yeah.
Okay.
They're engaged. But he was a GM executive. Yeah, very senior.
But they met on a McGill program.
They met on the IMPM, yeah.
What a small world it is.
At so, hockey.
At hockey, at a Canadians game, no less.
That's Lisa's most memorable game, I guess.
When you meet your future husband, yeah, that would stand out. So why photography, Susie? Lisa and you have been or are photographers. What's the appeal of photography?
Well, our other parents, or our mother is an artist. So we were kind of raised by an academic and an artist. So it makes for a kind of complicated and interesting upbringing. So I think we were both drawn to artistic stuff. Photography, I did photography as a young. I just sort of liked doing it, and then it ended up being my first profession. Lisa and I are different. Lisa does much more kind of nature photography. She'll do portraits and stuff too, but very interested in nature. And I was the opposite. I was photojournalism. So for me, it was people, stories. I think it was that. I loved capturing stories. I loved meeting people, and it's ultimately what I do in social work. It's what I do in my research. I said to my supervisor, I don't care what methodology I end up calling my research at the end, as long as I'm telling stories. So it's always been stories. I love hearing where people come from and what they're about, and whether it's through a camera, whether it's through research, whether it's as a clinician, because I worked for 10 years kind of doing, you know.
So as a clinician, would you mainly listen as opposed to talk?
I'd say, as the kind of work I was doing, it's a lot of listening. I mean, you got to be able to hear people's stories. You got to give them the space. You got to, I think sometimes the best way to help people is just to take the time to hear them out, hear their stories. I think often, not just the stories, but hear what they have to say, what they're going through. A lot of listening, but obviously, there's intervening too and helping them and trying to sort of help them figure out, where they can get the help they need. And, or if you're doing, I worked in therapy too. So, kind of doing therapeutic interventions, but you can't be a good therapist and you can't be a good clinician if you're not a good listener.
So are you more of an introvert or extrovert?
It's a good question because I very much come across as an extrovert. I never shut up. My kids, it drives me crazy. I'm chatty. I like kind of meeting people, but I'm incredibly shy. So if you put me in a group of people I don't know, I will be the one in the corner not saying anything. So I always assumed I was an extrovert, but I think I'm an extroverted introvert. I'm a bit of both.
Ambivert.
I'm an ambivert. I need my quiet time, and I need to sort of, if it's too much, just leave me be. But when you see me kind of, you know, in my element, you would never think introvert because I'm very outgoing.
Don't forget the INSEAD story.
So we talked about being in Mintzberg coming up. I remember one time you told me a story about INSEAD. What was that story about?
So when I was kind of younger, I had no clue that my father was well known at all because we weren't raised. It didn't matter. He was a professor and he went to work and, you know, there was no question of fame or any of that. And the first time I kind of realized he was somebody is, so this is before INSEAD, I was studying at Trent University and I had a neighbor, I guess, studying business or management. We had been friends for a year. And one day I was in the hallway and he was like, Mintzberg, he's like, are you related to Henry? And I'm like, yeah, and my father. And like, he nearly fell to the ground. And I was just like, what? Like, literally, what's going on? Like, I'm like, is he famous? It was very funny. That's why I realized my father was well known. So that was sort of my introduction to, oh, he's famous. But the INSEAD story is that I can't remember when it was, but I was at INSEAD. He was working there and I was living in France at the time and had stopped by to kind of visit. And a student of his, or I don't know, some guy came up to me and kind of with these big eyes kind of looked at me and said, no, it was a guy. I'm sure it was a guy.
A woman, some student,
came up to me and said, you know, what's it like having a father like him? And I was just like, I don't know any other father. Like, what a ridiculous question. Like, it was just like, he's my father. I'm like, he goes to the bathroom. He sleeps at night. Like, I'm like, whatever. No,
yeah, like
it was,
said, it's the only father.
It's the only father. Yeah, probably I said that. Yeah. So that's a story kind of he likes. But it is. I mean, my parents raised us very humbly. It was like I said, you know, earlier on, it was we had to make our own way. It wasn't about riding anyone's coattails. So
Henry, you became famous through your ideas, but that you didn't seek fame, but you didn't go for the money. Why didn't you go for the money, like consulting or, you know, giving speeches for money all the time?
What would I do with it? I mean, right now I have everything I need and the kids are well looked after. And so what, more money just for its own sake? Too many people chase it just to keep score. No, I love what I do. And luckily it pays off because some of my books sell. So I was able to.
So you have a comfortable life.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would I waste it chasing money?
So are you more an introvert or extrovert?
Like Susie, I guess both.
Okay.
Yeah, probably in the same way. I can be very introvertish in one place and very extrovertish in another place. Okay. I don't think I'm one or the other.
Well, I think this is an excellent segue to finish off. I want to take a moment to hear from our show producer, Gabby Hartshorn-Mell, an undergrad student of mine at McGill, and also a Generation Z like Susie Kids. Gabby, what is your Z take on the Mintzbergs?
Thank you very much, Professor Moore. Obviously, you taught me a lot about Henry Mintzberg's emergent strategy when I was in your class, and so it has been an honor to hear from someone so prevalent in business academia, and especially to hear more about who he is as a person and about his family.
We've all appreciated the personal stories he shared. It can help put a face to the name we've seen written about in our textbooks so often.
Definitely. And as someone passionate about writing myself, I also found it useful to hear his writing process. Although I come from a generation that uses computers as much as possible, I agree that part of the birthing process of producing a piece involves printing it out and reading it from the paper. And for Susie, I really appreciate what she says about teenage mental health during the pandemic. This is something I resonate with, and I'm grateful it did not go unnoticed by the professionals. That and her puck catching story was very entertaining.
Glad you enjoyed this episode, Gabby. Thanks again, Henry and Susie. A pleasure as always. I'd like to thank our technical producer, Marco Campagna, and to our listeners for tuning into the CO Series. À la prochaine.